rally the Fourth Army for the defence of Damascus, was intercepted by the 2nd Australian Light Horse Brigade. The Turkish soldiers agreed to surrender, but, surrounded by hostile Arab tribesmen, refused to lay down their arms. Prisoners and their captors proceeded together under arms to Oman before the Turks felt secure enough from Bedouin attack to surrender their weapons. As the Ottoman army fell back on Damascus, the Arab army and Allenby's EEF combined forces in a drive to take the Syrian capital. The Arab army stormed Daraa on the night of 26 to 27 September and was joined there by British forces the following day. They advanced immediately on Damascus, with Anzac and Indian cavalry circling around from northern Palestine to cut the Ottoman line of retreat towards Beirut in the west and Homs in the north. British and Arab forces advanced due north from Daraa, marching the 70 miles to Damascus in relentless pursuit of the remainder of the Ottoman Fourth Army. On 30 September, the Allies were on the outskirts of Damascus. The politics of the Palestine campaign came to a head with the entry to Damascus. Given the many partition plans negotiated in the course of the war, political considerations had never been far from Allenby's campaign. In June, he received two Jewish battalions of Royal Fusiliers, formed with the express intention of advancing the Zionist claim to Palestine by valour and sacrifice on the battlefield. The French contributed the Détachement Français de Palestine et de Syrie to ensure that France protected its long-standing claims to Syria. One regiment of the French detachment was made up entirely of Armenian refugees rescued by the French from the famous siege of Moussa Dagh. Amir Faisal was at the front of the line, with T.E. Lawrence as his advocate, to uphold Hashemite claims to rule Syria as part of a greater Arab kingdom. Stakeholders of the Hussein-McMahon correspondence, the Sykes-Picot agreements, and the Balfour Declaration jostled for preeminence as the campaign reached its climax at the gates of Damascus. To reward their Hashemite allies, the British conceded the honour of accepting the city's surrender to Amir Faisal's Arab army. However, the 3rd Australian Light Horse Brigade gained the distinction of being the first to enter Damascus. The cavalry unit was granted permission to traverse Damascus at dawn on 1 October to cut the Ottoman line of retreat down the main road north to Homs. It needn't have bothered. The last Ottoman troops had already boarded the train for Rayak the night before and left the city in the hands of a committee of urban notables. Turkish flags had been replaced with Sharifian colours in anticipation of Faisal's entry. The Australians quickly departed Damascus to take up their assigned positions and to leave the city for the Sharifian army to occupy formally. Sharif Nasser, who had served the Hashemite cause from the start of the revolt, entered Damascus on behalf of Sharif Hussein of Mecca, the self-proclaimed king of the Arabs. He was accompanied by Auda Abu Tayy and Nuri Shalan, the two most powerful Bedouin sheikhs to support Faisal's campaign, at the head of some 1,500 Bedouin soldiers. The townspeople lined the streets to welcome the Hashemite forces as liberators, though the merchants were nervous. As they feared, the Bedouin began to raid and plunder the city shortly after entering. British and Allied forces began to make their way into the liberated city, overwhelmed by the crowds and the sense of elation among a people who rightly saw the retreat of the Ottomans as the final act in a long and terrible war. The pageantry continued over the next 2 days, as first General Allenby made his entry into Damascus, and finally, on 3 October 1918, Amir Faisal himself arrived. Hubert Young, a British officer seconded to the Arab revolt as a sort of understudy for T.E. Lawrence, drove out to meet Faisal in the large red Mercedes that Lehman von Zonders had abandoned in Damascus. He found the Arab prince at the head of a large band of horsemen, riding through narrow streets thronged with exultant Damascenes, and offered to drive him back to the city's centre. Faisal declined the lift, preferring to enter Damascus on an Arab charger rather than in a German limousine. Faisal rode straight to the aptly named Victoria Hotel for a historic first meeting with General Allenby. What should have been a moment of celebration was overshadowed by the politics of partition, as Allenby, with Lawrence as his interpreter, took the opportunity to spell out the new administrative arrangements for Amir Faisal. In line with the Balfour Declaration, the Arab administration would have no status in Palestine. In deference to French interests established through the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the Arab government would have no role in Lebanon, which France would administer. In deference to French wishes, Faisal would ensure that the Sharifian flag was removed from public buildings in Beirut. Finally, so long as war conditions prevailed, Allenby would exercise supreme command over all Entente-occupied Arab territory. From his meeting with Allenby at the Victoria Hotel, Faisal made his way to the town hall to receive the acclaim of the Damascene public. Yet, after his meeting with Allenby, one wonders how he felt to be celebrated as the liberator of Damascus. The British pursued the Ottomans for the rest of the month, taking all of the main cities of Syria and Lebanon. The Ottomans never managed to establish a defensive line to put a halt to the British war of movement that began on 19 September. The fall of Aleppo on 26 October marked the end of a campaign that had fulfilled all of its objectives. The destruction of the Ottoman army in Syria would force the Ottomans out of the war. This goal had been reached with remarkably few Allied casualties, 5,666 killed, wounded, or missing. There is no official figure for Turkish casualties in the campaign, though the British claim to have taken 75,000 prisoners. The Central Powers were in terminal decline by the time of the Ottoman defeat in Syria. More and more countries around the world were joining the Entente Powers. In July 1917, Greece declared war on the Central Powers, followed by China in August. Several South American countries either declared war on Germany or severed ties with the German state. Yet the American expeditionary force decisively shifted the balance of power in the Entente's favour. In the 18 months after declaring war on Germany, the American army grew from 100,000 to 4 million men and managed to deploy 2 million soldiers overseas. Exhausted after 4 years of relentless slaughter, Germany and her allies could not find the men and materiel to meet the American threat. Bulgaria was the first to fall, concluding an armistice with the French commander in Salonika on 30 September 1918. Bulgaria's capitulation severed communications between Turkey and Germany, cutting the flow of arms and supplies that had sustained the Ottoman war effort for so long. The end was in sight for the Germans as well. A string of Allied victories on the Western Front had German forces on the retreat. When the Young Turks learned that their German ally had approached U.S. President Woodrow Wilson to mediate a ceasefire with Britain and France, the Ottomans knew they had no choice but to sue for peace as well. In Istanbul, the Ottoman government was in turmoil. The Unionist cabinet, headed by Talat Pasha, resigned on 8 October. The ruling triumvirate, Grand Vizier Talat, Minister of War Enver, and former Supreme Commander in Syria, Minister of Marine Jamal, who bore collective responsibility for Ottoman wartime decision-making, could only have complicated efforts to negotiate an armistice with the victorious allies. For 1 week, the empire went without a government, as no credible statesman could be found to lead the Ottomans into surrender. Eventually, Ahmet Izzet Pasha, who had commanded the Ottoman army in the Caucasus, agreed to form a new government to conclude a peace agreement. The new government dispatched its highest-ranking prisoner of war to initiate discussions with the British for an armistice. General Charles Townshend, former commander of the besieged garrison at Kut El Amara, had spent the remainder of the war in the comfort of a villa on the Prince's Islands in the Sea of Marmara. Townshend had been discredited for accepting enemy hospitality, not least when the other survivors of Kut had suffered such terrible fates. Townshend was dispatched to the island of Lesbos, where he conveyed Ottoman intentions to withdraw from the war. The commander of the British Mediterranean Squadron, Admiral Sir Somerset A. Gough Calthorpe, invited an Ottoman delegation to the island of Lemnos to receive armistice terms. The choice of venue could only have reinforced Ottoman bitterness. The island had been seized by Greece in the First Balkan War, and its port of Mudros had served as Britain's base of operations during the Gallipoli campaign. Terms were concluded in 4 days of negotiations, and British and Ottoman delegates signed the armistice agreement aboard the battle-scarred HMS Agamemnon, a veteran of the Gallipoli campaign, on 30 October. The terms of the armistice in themselves were none too harsh. Admiral Calthorpe secured the Ottoman Empire's total surrender, but left it to the politicians to impose more draconian terms through the peace treaty. The Ottomans were to open the straits to the Allied fleet, clearing a safe passage through the minefields and placing the Dardanelles forts under Allied control. All Ottoman soldiers were to be demobilized with immediate effect, and all naval vessels surrendered to the British and French. The communication network, rail, telegraph, and wireless facilities, was to come under Allied supervision. German and Austrian forces were given 1 month to evacuate Ottoman territory. Allied POWs and any Armenian internees were to be transported to Istanbul and handed over unconditionally to the Allies, but Ottoman POWs were to remain in Allied hands. Elements of the Mudras Armistice would have raised Ottoman concerns for the future. The Armenians were mentioned twice, a reminder to the Ottoman authorities that they would be held accountable for wartime crimes against humanity. And there were intimations of partitions to come, in demands for the withdrawal of Ottoman troops from Cilicia, where France had staked a claim, in acknowledgement of the Allies' right to occupy any strategic points for their own security, and in assertions of their right to occupy any part of the 6 Armenian vilayets in case of disorder. By signing the document, the Turkish delegates were effectively forced to concede the Armenians had a stronger claim to the 6 provinces of eastern Anatolia than the Ottomans themselves. In accordance with the terms of the armistice, hostilities ended at noon on 31 October 1918. The Ottoman War ended nearly 1 year after Russia's, and just 11 days shy of the German surrender on 11 November. The Ottomans had surprised everyone by surviving to the final days of the war, but they had gained nothing from their tenacity. The length of the war had only imposed greater hardship and brought greater despair to the experience of defeat. With the end of hostilities, soldiers celebrated their survival and dreamed of going home. Now the water that had to run and the wind that had to blow, they are gone, an Indian trooper wrote his brother in Urdu. Now we may hope for perfect calm, and that we shall return to India in peace. He spoke for the hopes of soldiers from all corners of the earth, who had struggled and survived the Great War on the Ottoman front. Conclusion. The Fall of the Ottomans. The Ottomans had lost the Great War. It was a national catastrophe, but not unprecedented. Since 1699, the Ottomans had lost most of the wars they had fought, and still the empire had survived. Yet never had the Ottomans faced such a constellation of interests as they did in negotiating the peace after the Great War. Caught between the conflicting demands of the victorious powers and Turkish nationalists, the Ottomans ultimately fell more as a result of the terms of the peace than of the magnitude of their defeat. On 13 November 1918, an Allied fleet negotiated the recently cleared minefields of the Dardanelles to steam into Istanbul. The Ottoman capital, having eluded capture since the start of the war, lay defenceless before the victorious powers. 42 vessels, led by the dreadnought HMS Agamemnon, descended on the Dolmabahçe Palace, dominating the Bosporus waterfront. A squadron of biplanes passed over the British, French, Italian, and Greek warships, completing the spectacle. Admiral Somerset Gough Calthorpe and the other officers disembarked to take possession of the city. Entente soldiers marched through the streets to the strains of military bands. Istanbul's Christian inhabitants welcomed them as heroes. Grigoris Balakian was among the crowds watching the fleet's arrival from the Istanbul hilltops. Against all the odds, the Armenian priest had survived the genocide to make his way back to his native city in September 1918. Ever fearful of rearrest, Balakian had remained in hiding for the next 2 months, moving between the homes of his mother and sister, who had long since given him up for dead. He spent the days writing his account of the Armenian Golgotha, capturing all the suffering he had witnessed at first hand and heard from others, while the painful memories were still fresh. Yet he wanted to see for himself the arrival of the Allied fleet, marking the moment that Armenian wartime suffering would finally come to an end. Making his way from the Asian to the European quarters of Istanbul, Balakian donned a redingote and top hat as a precaution to hide his identity. The Turkish boatman who rowed him across the Bosporus did not suspect he was carrying an Armenian priest. "Effendi," he lamented, "what bad times we're living in, what black days we have fallen upon. Talat and Enver have destroyed the fatherland, picked up and fled, and left us to our fate. Who would have believed that a foreign fleet would enter Constantinople so illustriously, and that we Muslims would be simple spectators?" Balakian surprised himself when he turned to comfort the man, assuring him, "These black days will pass too." Also among the crowds that day was German General Otto Liemann von Sanders. He had served the Ottoman Empire for 5 years as head of the German mission and ultimately as commander of the Yildirim group in Palestine. He had narrowly escaped capture in Nazareth in September and retreated through Syria with the British in hot pursuit. In Adana, he turned over command of the remaining Ottoman forces to Turkish General Mustafa Kemal Pasha, the hero of Gallipoli. Liemann then returned to Istanbul to oversee the repatriation of German forces from the Ottoman Empire in line with the terms of the armistice. Though they viewed the day's events from very different perspectives, Liemann and Balakian gave strikingly similar descriptions of Istanbul as the Allied fleet occupied the city. Greek, French, British, and Italian flags festooned the houses. Christian girls threw flowers at the victorious soldiers as they passed through the streets, while men tossed their hats in the air and embraced each other in celebration. As the day wore on, wine flowed as townspeople and occupiers fraternized. Both Liemann and Balakian found the drunken revels distasteful. "None would have credited these demonstrations with any dignity," Liemann sniffed, while Balakian regretted how the Turkish capital had become a Babylon. While Istanbul's Christians celebrated, the Muslim majority watched the Allied soldiers take possession of their city in silence from behind their shuttered windows, overwhelmed by humiliation and despair. Their anger, like that of the boatman who had ferried Balakian across the Bosporus, focused on the leaders of the Committee of Union and Progress, CUP, who, having brought the whole misery of war on an unwilling populace, had fled immediately after the armistice went into effect. In the middle of the night on 1 November, the Young Turk leadership boarded a German naval vessel in total secrecy to flee Ottoman domains. Mehmed Talat, Ismail Enver, and Ahmed Cemal, accompanied by four of their closest advisers, sailed to Odessa and made their way overland from the Black Sea coast to Berlin. Their German allies, knowing the Unionists would face victor's justice, assisted in their escape and granted the fugitives asylum. The Ottoman newspapers, on the other hand, expressed public outrage over the CUP triumvir's flight, leaving the Turkish nation to face the consequences of Unionist policies and wartime atrocities, particularly the Armenian massacres. In the chamber of the Ottoman parliament and in the Turkish press, an open debate raged about the Armenian massacres in November 1918. Then, as now, there was no agreed-on figure for the number of Armenians killed by government wartime measures. In their deliberations, members of the Ottoman parliament cited figures ranging from 800,000 to 1.5 million Armenian civilians massacred. Regardless of whether one subscribed to the high or low estimate, or to some figure in between, it was clear that the genocide would cast a long shadow over peace negotiations with the victorious Entente powers. The Entente powers openly condemned the Ottoman government for the Armenian massacres. America and Britain were particularly outspoken in calling for retributive justice for the Turks' wartime crimes against humanity. In order to avoid a draconian peace settlement, the new Ottoman government decided to establish military tribunals to try those accused of responsibility for the annihilation of the Armenian community. They hoped to focus international condemnation on the Young Turk leadership as the architects of the genocide, rather than punishing the Turkish people as a whole. Between January and March 1919, the Ottoman authorities ordered the arrest of 300 Turkish officials. Among those detained were provincial governors and Unionist members of parliament, as well as lower-ranking local officials. Though the police struck without warning, making their arrests in the middle of the night, many, like the triumvirate and their advisers, who were already in exile, were tried in absentia. The main military tribunal was convened in Istanbul. The trials were open to the public, with the state's evidence and court decisions published in the official gazette, the Takvim-i Vekayi. The published indictments lay full responsibility for the mass murder of Armenian civilians on the Young Turk leadership. The prosecutors asserted, these massacres were carried out under the orders and with the knowledge of Talat, Enver and Jamal. They quoted an official in Aleppo who claimed to have received the order for annihilation from Talat himself, and was convinced that the well-being of the country depended on the extermination of the Armenian population. In one telegram presented as evidence before the court, Dr. Bahayeddin Shaka, the alleged architect of the genocide, demanded of the governor of Marmara Tuğlaziz an honest report on the liquidation of Armenians from his province. Are the troublemakers, whom you reported as being driven forth and banished, being destroyed, or are they merely being driven out and sent away? Witness testimony revealed how the mass murder was organized. The official printed orders calling for deportation were followed by oral instructions to massacre deportees. Evidence was presented of convicted murderers released from prison and mobilized in gangs to serve as butchers of men. The prosecutors assembled compelling documentation linking Enver's secret intelligence service, the Teşkilat-i Mahsusa, to the formation of the murder gangs. And they assembled extensive evidence of mass killings, individuals claiming responsibility for the death of thousands, and provinces reporting deportations numbering in the hundreds of thousands. After months of deliberations, the courts passed death sentences on 18 defendants for their roles in the Armenian massacres. Talat, Enver, and Jamal faced capital punishment, along with key CUP leaders, such as Dr. Bahayeddin Shaka and Dr. Mehmed Nazım, who had followed them into exile. With 15 of the condemned tried in absentia, only 3 lower-ranking officials were ultimately sent to the gallows. Mehmed Kemal, Lieutenant Governor of Yozgat, whom Grigoris Balakian claimed was responsible for the massacre of 42,000 Armenians, was hanged on 10 April 1919. The commander of the Erzincan Gendarmerie, Hafiz Abdullah Avni, was executed on 22 July 1920. The third and final execution was held on 5 August 1920, with the hanging of the district head of Beyburt, Biramzadeh Nusret. By August 1920, it was clear that the military tribunal was not going to bring the main perpetrators of the Armenian massacres to justice. It was equally clear that the trials would not spare the Ottoman Empire from a draconian peace settlement. Once they had outlived their usefulness, the military tribunals lapsed into inactivity. But the record of these trials provides the most extensive evidence ever compiled by the Turkish authorities on the organization and the conduct of the Armenian massacres. These records, published in Ottoman Turkish, have been in the public domain since 1919 and make a mockery of any attempt to deny the Young Turk government's role in ordering and organizing the annihilation of the Ottoman Armenian community. Unwilling to watch the Young Turk leaders in exile escape justice, a group of Armenian militants from the Dashnak organization took the law into their own hands. Between March 1921 and July 1922, the Dashnaks ordered a series of assassinations of key Young Turk leaders in a program known as Operation Nemesis. The assassins struck first in Berlin, where many of the leading Young Turks had taken refuge. On 15 March 1921, a 25-year-old genocide survivor from Erzincan, named Sogoman Telerian, gunned down Talat Pasha. The young assassin was arrested, tried, and acquitted by a German court on the grounds of diminished responsibility due to the mental trauma and personal losses he had suffered in the Armenian massacres. Arshavir Sharagian, a 21-year-old native of Istanbul, who had already assassinated former Grand Vizier Said Halim Pasha in Rome on 5 December 1921, took part in a second attack in which both Dr. Bahayeddin Shaka and Jamal Azmi, the murderous governor of Trabzon province, were shot dead in Berlin on 17 April 1922. The two surviving triumvirs, Jamal and Enver met their deaths in the Caucasus and Central Asia. Armenian assassins tracked Jamal Pasha, wartime governor-general of Syria, to the Georgian city of Tbilisi, where he was killed on 25 July 1922. He would have been surprised to learn that his killers were Armenian rather than Arab. While widely despised in Syria for his execution of Arab nationalists, Jamal is credited with having settled Armenian deportees, some 60,000 by January 1916 alone, across the Syrian provinces. Yet measures to convert Armenian survivors of the death marches to Islam, which amounted to the annihilation of the Armenians by other means, undermined his humanitarian efforts. Among the former ruling triumvirate, only Enver eluded assassination. The young Turk leader made his last stand near Dushanbe, in the Tajik-Uzbek border regions, and was killed leading a Muslim militia in battle against the Bolsheviks in August 1922. By 1926, 10 of the 18 men sentenced to death by the Istanbul military courts for their role in the Armenian genocide were dead. The other 8, mass murderers lower down the chain of command, escaped execution, but their convictions left them feeling like marked men for the rest of their days. There was nothing the Ottomans could do to soften the terms the Allies would impose at the Paris Peace Conference. From the very outset of the war, Britain, France, and Russia had negotiated the future partition of Ottoman domains. Though Russia had retracted its claims after the Bolshevik Revolution, new allies had taken its place. Italy and Greece, both relative latecomers to the Ottoman front. Italy declared war on Turkey in August 1915, and Greece only in June 1917, proved no less avid to acquire Ottoman territory than the Tsar's government had been. In April 1919, the Italians landed troops in the Mediterranean port of Antalya, and on 15 May, Greek forces occupied the port of Izmir. When the Ottoman delegates appeared before the Supreme Council of the Paris Peace Conference in June 1919, they could have had little confidence of a sympathetic hearing. Appealing to President Wilson's principles, the 12th of Woodrow Wilson's famous 14 points called for a secure sovereignty for the Turkish portion of the present Ottoman Empire, they set out their vision for the post-war Ottoman Empire. In essence, they sought to retain all territory within their October 1914 frontiers, divided between areas of direct Turkish rule in Anatolia and Thrace, and autonomous zones with a high degree of local rule under the Ottoman flag, in the Arab provinces and the disputed Aegean islands. Nobody in Turkey is unaware of the gravity of the moment, the Ottoman delegation's memorandum concluded. The ideas of the Ottoman people are, however, well defined. It will not accept the dismemberment of the empire or its division under different mandates. 5 days after the Ottoman delegation submitted its memorandum, the Allies and Germany signed the Treaty of Versailles on 28 June 1919. The treaty set a high benchmark for the harsh terms the victorious powers would impose on the defeated Central Powers. Germany was forced to accept responsibility for the loss and damage caused by the war. Its military was to undergo disarmament. It faced substantial territorial losses in excess of 25,000 square miles, and Germany was ordered to pay unprecedented reparations of $31.4 billion, £6.6 billion. The terms dealt the other defeated powers were hardly less draconian. The peace with Austria, signed at Saint-Germain-en-Laye on 10 September 1919, imposed the dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, forced Austria to accept responsibility for causing the war, imposed heavy war reparations, and distributed Austrian territory to a number of successor states, including Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, subsequently renamed Yugoslavia. In November 1919, the Allies signed the Treaty of Neuilly-sur-Seine with Bulgaria, remembered in national histories as the Second National Catastrophe. The first had been Bulgaria's defeat in the Second Balkan War of 1913. The treaty forced Bulgaria to cede territory in western Thrace, ultimately awarded to Greece, and on its western frontiers, and left the country saddled with £100 million in reparations. The peace treaty with Hungary, signed at the Trianon on 4 June 1920, reduced the Hungarian lands of the former Austro-Hungarian Empire to 28% of its pre-war territory and left the landlocked state saddled with a major reparations bill. There was little reason to expect the Ottoman Empire would face more generous terms than its wartime allies. In fact, the Treaty of Versailles, signed with Germany, incorporated the Covenant of the League of Nations, giving the sanction of international law to a mandate system designed expressly to allow for the partition of the Ottoman Empire. Article 22 of the Covenant read, "Certain communities formerly belonging to the Turkish Empire have reached a stage of development where their existence as independent nations can be provisionally recognized, subject to the rendering of administrative advice and assistance by a mandatory, until such time as they are able to stand alone." After the Turkish delegation returned to Istanbul, the victorious powers engaged in a final round of negotiations to agree on the ultimate distribution of Ottoman territory. The prime ministers of Great Britain, France, and Italy met in the Italian resort of San Remo in April 1920 to resolve the contradictions between the Hussein-McMahon correspondence, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and the Balfour Declaration. After 6 days of discussion, the three powers, with Japan as a disinterested observer, agreed that Britain would be awarded mandates over Palestine, including Transjordan, and Mesopotamia, and France would secure the mandate over Syria, including Lebanon. The Italian government withheld its formal approval of the agreement until its declared interest in Anatolia had been satisfied. Once the Allies had agreed on the partition of the Arab lands, they turned to finalize the peace treaty with the Ottoman Empire. The terms, first shared with the Porte in May 1920, could not have been worse for the Turks. In addition to transferring all of the Arab provinces to European mandatory control, the draft peace agreement called for the partition of Anatolia and the distribution of territories with Turkish majority populations among former subject peoples and hostile neighbors. Eastern Anatolia was to be divided between the Armenians and the Kurds. The northeastern provinces of Trabzon, Erzurum, Bitlis, and Van were designated an Armenian sphere of influence. These four provinces enjoyed the full freedom, under American arbitration, to secede from the Ottoman Empire and join the new Armenian Republic in the Caucasus, with its capital in Yerevan. The Kurds were offered a smaller territory on the southern frontiers of the Armenian zone, based around the town of Diyarbakir. Under the terms of the treaty, the Kurds, too, were given full freedom to secede from the Ottoman Empire and to establish an independent state. In western Anatolia, the port city of Smyrna, modern Izmir, and its hinterlands were placed under Greek administration. The government of Greece was instructed to assist the local Greek community in electing a parliament that would enjoy the authority to legislate Smyrna's future union with the Kingdom of Greece. Most of Turkish Thrace, including the city of Edirne, which the Ottomans had lost in the First Balkan War and recovered in the Second, was also ceded to the Greeks. The Ottomans even lost control over the strategic waterways linking the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. The Bosporus, the Dardanelles, and the Sea of Marmara were to be placed under an international commission that Turkey would only be allowed to join if and when it was admitted to the League of Nations. The partition of Anatolia did not end there. By separate agreement concluded between Britain, France, and Italy, the Mediterranean regions of Anatolia were to be divided between the French and Italians. The Cilician coast, reaching deep inland to Sivas, was designated a French sphere of influence. Italian claims to southwest Anatolia, including the port of Antalya and the inland city of Konya, were also recognized. Though nominally still part of the Ottoman Empire, Turkey's Mediterranean coast would effectively fall under informal French or Italian colonial rule. The draft peace treaty left very little territory to the Turks. The Ottoman Empire was effectively reduced to those parts of central Anatolia that no one else wanted: Bursa, Ankara, and Samsun on the Black Sea coast, with Istanbul as its capital. And even Istanbul was awarded to the Turks on sufferance. If the Ottomans failed to uphold their treaty commitments, the Allies threatened to retract the award of Constantinople to the post-war Turkish state. The terms of the settlement provoked widespread opposition across the Ottoman Empire. The presence of foreign armies on Turkish soil already had engendered profound resentment. In May 1919, Mustafa Kemal Pasha, hero of Gallipoli and the nation's most respected military leader, had been sent to Samsun to oversee the demobilization of Ottoman troops in line with the terms of the armistice. Following the Italian and Greek occupations of Cilicia and Izmir in April and May 1919, Mustafa Kemal decided to disobey his orders to demobilize the army and mounted a resistance movement against the invasion of Anatolia instead. He established his base in the central Anatolian town of Ankara, where the Turkish national movement he launched increasingly rivaled the Ottoman government in Istanbul in representing the political aspirations of the Turkish people. Between July and September 1919, the Turkish national movement convened two congresses, in Erzurum and Sivas, that set out its principles in a document known as the National Pact. The National Pact sought to reconcile a just and lasting peace with a stable Ottoman sultanate, through a clear statement of principles. The framers of the National Pact accepted the loss of the Arab provinces and were open to arrangements to ensure free navigation of the straits, but they ruled out any partition of those territories which are inhabited by an Ottoman, read Turkish, Muslim majority, united in religion, in race, and in aim, claiming those territories form a whole which does not admit of division for any reason. In one of its final sessions, the Ottoman Parliament in Istanbul threw in its lot with the Turkish national movement in Ankara and adopted the National Pact by overwhelming majority in January 1920. However popular the nationalists' policies were with parliamentarians, the Porte viewed the Turkish national movement in central Anatolia as a dangerous threat to its authority. In the national crisis that followed the release of the Allied peace terms in May 1920, the Ottoman government believed it had no choice but to cooperate with the victorious powers. By accepting the victorious powers' harsh terms in the short run, the Porte hoped to secure better terms in the long run. The Turkish national movement, on the other hand, believed the Ottomans would never recover the territory or sovereignty surrendered in the peace treaty. Mustafa Kemal and his partisans called for the rejection of the draconian terms and resistance to any partition of Anatolia. The Porte believed the course of confrontation advocated by Mustafa Kemal and the Turkish national movement, given the shattered state of the Ottoman military and economy, would lead to catastrophe. Resistance might even cost the Ottomans their capital city, Istanbul, given the conditions of the peace treaty. The Ottoman government charged Mustafa Kemal and several other nationalist leaders with high treason, and in May 1920, the same military court that had conducted the Armenian trials sentenced the hero of Gallipoli to death in absentia. History was to prove the Grand Vizier and his cabinet wrong. Only resistance to the peace treaty would preserve Turkish sovereignty, and Mustafa Kemal was no traitor. A committed Ottomanist, Mustafa Kemal had framed his every act in terms of preserving the Sultan's state. The National Pact even used the word Ottoman rather than Turk to describe the nation. The breaking point for the Kemalists came when the Ottoman government committed the Turkish nation to the draconian peace and the partition of Anatolia under foreign occupation. In signing the Treaty of Sèvres on 10 August 1920, the Porte provoked an irreconcilable split with the Turkish national movement. From that date forward, the Kemalists worked to bring down both the treaty and the Ottoman government that signed it. By 1922, after an intense war on three fronts, against the Armenians in the Caucasus, the French in Cilicia, and the Greeks in western Anatolia, the Kemalists achieved total victory over all foreign armies in Turkey. After concluding an armistice with Greece on 11 October 1922, the Turkish Grand National Assembly voted to abolish the Ottoman Sultanate on 1 November. After only 4 years on the throne, Mehmed VI, who succeeded his half-brother Mehmed V in July 1918, 4 months before the end of the war, the last Ottoman Sultan, was sent into exile aboard a British warship bound for Malta on 17 November. In July 1923, the nationalist government in Turkey signed a new treaty with the victorious powers in Lausanne, Switzerland, that recognized Turkey's independence more or less within its present boundaries. On the strength of that international recognition, the Turkish Republic was proclaimed on 29 October 1923, with Mustafa Kemal as the new country's first president. The Turkish Parliament later awarded Mustafa Kemal the surname Atatürk, literally Father of the Turks, in recognition of his leadership in the creation of modern Turkey. Had the Sultan's government harnessed Atatürk's movement and resisted the terms imposed by the victorious powers at Sèvres, the Ottoman Empire might well have survived within the boundaries of the modern Turkish Republic. However catastrophic their defeat in the Great War, acceptance of the draconian peace led to the fall of the Ottomans. With the end of hostilities in October 1918, soldiers from both sides of the trenches were eager to return home. The first to depart from the Middle East were the soldiers of the defeated Central Powers. In line with the terms of the armistice, Liman von Sanders oversaw the repatriation of German soldiers from Ottoman domains. Initially, German and Austrian troops already in Istanbul were shipped to Odessa to make their way home overland through Ukraine. However, the 1,200 German and Austrian soldiers with the 6th Army in Mesopotamia took weeks to reach Istanbul, as did those serving in Syria and Palestine. Liman estimated there were 10,000 men to be shipped by late December 1918. He secured 5 steamships to transport them directly from Istanbul to Germany, and at the end of January 1919, Liman boarded ship with 120 officers and 1,800 men for the long journey back to their war-shattered homes. So ended the German-Ottoman alliance. There remained a large number of Ottoman troops in Allied-occupied territory. Fahri Pasha, commander of the Ottoman garrison at Medina, enjoyed the distinction of being the last Turkish general to surrender. Though under total siege since the closing months of the war, the Ottoman garrison in Medina had rationed its provisions and refused every overture to capitulate. After the armistice, the British High Commissioner in Egypt, Sir Reginald Wingate, wrote to Fahri to persuade him to surrender. The stubborn Turkish general refused outright, responding, "I am an Osmanlı, Ottoman. I am a Mohammedan. I am the son of Bali Bey, and I am a soldier." Between his devotion to the Sultan and his veneration for the Prophet's mosque in Medina, Fahri had no intention of yielding his sword to an Englishman. For 10 weeks after the armistice, the Ottoman garrison held out. As Arab forces threatened to storm the city, Fahri Pasha locked himself into the Prophet's mosque with crates of ammunition and threatened to blow up the sacred shrine rather than surrender. His men, however, demoralized by weeks of privation made worse by knowledge of the war's end, began to desert their commander to surrender to the Arab army. Finally, on 10 January 1919, the zealous general was persuaded to deliver the holy city to Hashemite forces. He emerged from Medina depressed and angry, Amir Abdullah recalled, looking round like a caged lion and finding no escape. He was seen off with full honours from the port of Yanbu, boarded a British destroyer, and set sail for captivity in Egypt. The evacuation of Ottoman troops took place over the following weeks under Amir Abdullah's supervision, with Arab soldiers from the Ottoman garrison pressed into the Hashemite army, and Turkish soldiers sent on to Egypt, where they were detained in POW camps until they could be repatriated to Turkey. French colonial authorities made North African soldiers recruited to Ottoman service from German POW camps pay for their wartime disloyalty. Already since Major General Stanley Maud's occupation of Baghdad in 1917, thousands of North African soldiers had passed from Ottoman service into British prison camps. They were dispatched in due course to France for repatriation. A number of camps were opened in southern France to receive native troops from Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. Those deemed of dubious loyalty were barred from returning to North Africa or fraternizing with Muslims in France. Of all Great War veterans, few fought on so many fronts with so little incentive as the North African POWs. Allied forces remained in service long after the armistice as an army of occupation. The Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire were brought under an Allied-occupied enemy territory administration. Inevitably, tensions emerged between local communities, resentful of foreign occupiers, and British and Dominion forces hardened by the war and impatient to return home. In Palestine, the killing of a New Zealand sergeant by a local villager set off a retaliatory massacre in mid-December 1918. Accounts vary, but between 60 and 200 New Zealanders surrounded the village of Sarafand, where the sergeant's killer was believed to have taken refuge. They drove out the women, children, and elderly before attacking the men of the village. According to New Zealand sources, the vengeful soldiers killed or wounded over 30 men before setting fire to the village and a nearby encampment. General Edmund Allenby convened a formal inquiry into the massacre. In a determined conspiracy of silence, none of the soldiers in the Anzac units billeted around Sarafand would give evidence. By all accounts, Allenby was livid at the insubordination of his troops. Yet, rather than impose collective punishments that might provoke further rebellion, the British general decided to order the Anzac troops back to the Egyptian border at Rafah. It was the first stage in their planned demobilization and return to New Zealand and Australia. At Rafah, the army began to kill the Anzac cavalrymen's horses. To be precise, most were killed. Some were saved for the army of occupation, and a limited number in good health were set aside for sale. The troopers were given many explanations, that not enough ships were available to transport both the men and their mounts, that the horses were in no state for the long journey home, and that the animals risked carrying infectious diseases that would spread to the national herd in Australia and New Zealand. But the cavalrymen took this unexpected news badly. The parting of the men from their horses was pathetic, Sergeant C.G. Nicol of the Auckland Mounted Rifles recalled. After years of campaigning, the bond between the troopers and their horses was stronger than many felt for their fellow man. Though strictly forbidden, many troopers preferred to kill their own horses rather than leave them for the livestock market or the butcher. The Australian soldier-journalist Oliver Hoag, a veteran of both the Gallipoli and Palestine campaigns, who wrote under the pseudonym Trooper Bluegum, captured the typical cavalryman's sentiments towards his Waler, short for the most common breed of Australian warhorse, the New South Wales, in a poem titled The Horses Stay Behind. "I don't think I could stand the thought of my old fancy hack just crawling round old Cairo with a gippo on his back. Perhaps some English tourist out in Palestine may find my broken-hearted Waler with a wooden plough behind. No, I think I'd better shoot him and tell a little lie. He floundered in a wombat hole and then lay down to die. Maybe I'll get court-martialed, but I'm damned if I'm inclined to go back to Australia and leave my horse behind." The Anzac troops were scheduled to leave Egypt for home in mid-March 1919. Before they could board ship, Egypt exploded in a nationwide uprising that detained the Australians and New Zealanders a bit longer. Egypt and the Arab lands emerged from the Great War with heightened expectations of a new era of independence. The 12th of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points assured the Arabs, along with the other subject peoples of the Ottoman Empire, an undoubted security of life and an absolutely unmolested opportunity of autonomous development. Political activists were at work in Syria and Mesopotamia, debating different political visions, freed from the constraints imposed by decades of Ottoman political repression. In Egypt, political elites knew precisely what they wanted. After 36 years of British occupation, they wanted Egypt's total independence. A group of prominent Egyptian politicians approached the British authorities in Cairo to request permission to present their case for independence at the Paris Peace Conference. Sir Reginald Wingate, British High Commissioner, received the delegation led by veteran politician Saad Zaghloul 2 days after the armistice with Germany on 13 November 1918. He heard the delegates out and promptly declined their request to attend the peace conference in no uncertain terms. The Paris Peace Conference was to decide the fate of the defeated powers and in no way concerned Egypt. When Zaghloul and his colleagues persisted in their efforts, they were arrested on 8 March 1919 and deported to Malta. The following day, Egypt exploded in demonstrations that rapidly spread nationwide and across the different social classes in a common demand for independence. Egyptians in town and countryside attacked every visible manifestation of British imperial power. The railways and telegraph lines were sabotaged, government offices burned, and government centres confronted with huge crowds of protesters. The British dispatched soldiers to restore order, but soldiers are blunt tools for crowd control, and casualties began to mount. The Egyptians accused British soldiers of atrocities, of using live fire against demonstrators, burning villages, and even committing rape. By the end of March, 800 Egyptian civilians had been killed, and a further 1,600 injured in the violence. To restore the calm, the British allowed Zaghloul to return to Egypt and lead a delegation to Paris in April 1919. Before the Egyptian delegation reached Paris, British Prime Minister David Lloyd George had persuaded his French and American allies that Egypt was an imperial and not an international question. The day the Egyptian delegation reached Paris, President Wilson recognized Britain's protectorate over Egypt. The delegation was never granted a formal hearing by the peace conference. The war might have ended, but British rule in Egypt had not. Amir Faisal's Arab administration in Damascus also faced a sceptical hearing in Paris. While the Hashemite prince believed himself entitled to Entente support after serving the Allied cause by leading the Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire, his claims collided with French ambitions in Syria. Faisal presented his case for Arab independence to the Supreme Council of the Paris Peace Conference in January 1919. In light of the extensive territory Sir Henry McMahon had promised Sharif Hussein in their famous correspondence, Faisal's position was very moderate. He sought immediate and full independence for Arab kingdoms in Greater Syria, corresponding to the territory of the modern states of Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and the Palestinian Authority, and the Hejaz, then ruled by his father, King Hussein. He accepted foreign mediation in Palestine to resolve conflicting Arab and Zionist aspirations, and he acknowledged British claims to Mesopotamia, while expressing his belief that these territories would eventually join the independent Arab state he hoped to persuade the peacemakers to create. While accepting less than the Hashemites believed their British allies had promised, Faisal demanded more than the British could deliver. Prime Minister David Lloyd George needed French consent to secure British claims to Mesopotamia and Palestine, and from the very outset of the war, France had named Syria as its price. Unable to reconcile these rival claims, Britain backed its essential ally, France, and left Faisal to fend for himself. On 1 November 1919, the British withdrew their army from Syria and handed the country over to French military rule. The Syrian General Congress, an elected body convened by Faisal's supporters with representatives from the different regions of Greater Syria, responded on 8 March 1920 by declaring the independence of Syria with Faisal as their king. But Faisal's Syrian kingdom was not to survive. The French dispatched a colonial army from Lebanon to take control of Damascus. Encountering the remnants of Faisal's Arab army in a mountain pass on the road between Beirut and Damascus, the French easily defeated the token force of 2,000 defenders at Khan Maysaloun on 24 July 1920 and advanced into Damascus unopposed to overturn Faisal's short-lived Syrian kingdom. Faisal carried the dashed hopes of the Arab revolt into exile with him. The fall of Faisal's government in Damascus left the Palestinians to face the British occupation and the Balfour Declaration on their own. Notables from Palestinian towns and cities had played a key role in the Syrian General Congress, and the townsmen and villages they represented made their views known to the American Commission of Inquiry, sent in the summer of 1919 by the Paris Peace Conference. Between 10 June and 21 July, the King Crane Commission travelled across Greater Syria to gather evidence and assess public opinion about the region's political future. It was clear that a strong majority of Palestinian Arabs wished to be ruled as part of Faisal's Arab kingdom. Moreover, the King Crane Commission reported that the Palestinian Arab population was emphatically against the entire Zionist program, and that there was no one thing upon which the population of Palestine were more agreed than upon this. Tensions ran high in 1920 as Jewish immigration, encouraged by the Balfour Declaration, accelerated. Between 1919 and 1921, over 18,500 Zionist immigrants flocked to Palestine's shores. Rioting broke out in Jerusalem in the first week of April 1920, leaving 5 Jews and 4 Arabs dead and over 200 people injured. Worse violence followed in 1921, when Arab townsmen intervened in a fight between Jewish communists and Zionists in the port of Jaffa during May Day parades. In the ensuing riots, 47 Jews and 48 Arabs were killed, and over 200 people were injured. The contradictions raised by the Balfour Declaration, in its declaration of intent to create a national home for the Jews that would not adversely affect the rights and interests of the indigenous non-Jewish population, were already apparent. The political elites in Iraq watched events in Egypt and Syria with mounting concern for their own future. They had been reassured in November 1918 when the British and French issued a declaration pledging their support for the establishment of national governments and administrations in the Arab lands through a process of self-determination. But the Iraqis grew increasingly suspicious as the months passed without any tangible progress towards the promised self-government. News in April 1920 that the great powers had agreed in San Remo to award their country to Britain as a mandate confirmed the Iraqis' worst fears. At the end of June 1920, Iraq erupted in nationwide rebellion against British rule. Disciplined and well organized, the insurgency threatened the British in Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul, but the center of operations lay in the same Shiite shrine towns of the Middle Euphrates that had risen against the Ottomans during the Great War. As the uprising spread, the British were forced to move additional troops into Mesopotamia to suppress determined Iraqi resistance on all fronts. Reinforcements from India were rushed to bolster the 60,000 troops yet to be demobilized from the Mesopotamia campaign, raising British forces to over 100,000 by October. Using aerial bombardment and heavy artillery, the British reconquered the Middle Euphrates region with scorched earth tactics that crushed the resistance. In recent days there has been bloodshed and the destruction of populous towns and the violation of the sanctity of places of worship to make humanity weep, one journalist in Najaf wrote in October 1920. By the time the uprising was crushed at the end of October, the British claimed that 2,200 of their own forces and an estimated 8,450 Iraqis had been killed or wounded. Sharif Hussein, now King of Hejaz, followed events in Syria, Palestine, and Iraq with a deepening sense of betrayal. He had copies of every letter exchanged with Sir Henry McMahon and felt the British had broken every promise they contained. Having aspired to be King of the Arabs, Hussein was now confined to the Hejaz, and he wasn't even secure there. A rival monarchy in Central Arabia, led by Abd el-Aziz al-Saud, better known in the West as Ibn Saud, threatened to overrun the Hejaz. To add insult to injury, Ibn Saud enjoyed a treaty with Great Britain and received a generous monthly stipend from the British Treasury. The British, too, were concerned about the future of the Hejaz. While they had secured a formal treaty with Ibn Saud back in 1915, their relations with the Hashemites had been concluded in the form of a wartime alliance. Once the war was at an end, so too was the alliance. Unless the old king of the Hejaz concluded a treaty with Britain, Whitehall would have no legal basis to protect his territory. But to get King Hussein to sign a treaty, they had to get him to accept the post-war settlement hammered out at San Remo. In the summer of 1921, T.E. Lawrence was given the impossible mission of negotiating the terms of an Anglo-Hijazi treaty with the embittered King Hussein. By the time Lawrence met with King Hussein, Britain had gone some way towards redeeming Sir Henry McMahon's broken promises. Winston Churchill, now Secretary of State for the Colonies, had convened a secret meeting in Cairo in March 1921 to determine the political future of Britain's new Middle Eastern mandates. At that meeting, the British dignitaries agreed to install King Hussein's son Faisal as King of Iraq and Abdullah as ruler of the as-yet-undefined territory of Transjordan, which was formally separated from Palestine in 1923. With Hashemite rulers slated for all of Britain's mandates, bar Palestine, Churchill could claim to have worked within the spirit, if not the exact lettering, of McMahon's wartime undertakings. Between July and September 1921, Lawrence sought in vain the formula for reconciling King Hussein with Britain's post-war position in the Middle East. Hussein refused to confine his own ambitions to the Hejaz. He objected to the separation of Syria and Lebanon from the rest of the Arab lands and their placement under French mandate. He rejected the British mandates in Iraq and Transjordan, even if they were to be nominally ruled by his sons. And he refused to sanction the pledge to establish a Jewish national home in Palestine. As King Hussein could accept nothing in the British post-war settlement, there was no scope for an Anglo-Hijaz treaty of alliance. Lawrence returned to London empty-handed. The British made one last attempt to conclude a treaty with the Hijaz in 1923, but the bitter old king refused, forfeiting British protection at the very moment Ibn Saud was preparing to conquer the Red Sea province. On 6 October 1924, King Hussein abdicated in favour of his eldest son, Ali, and went into exile. King Ali's reign ended in late 1925, when the Saudis completed the conquest of the Hijaz. Like the Ottomans before them, the Hashemites made their last stand in Medina, surrendering the holy city in December 1925, nearly 7 years after Fakhri Pasha's capitulation. In the end, the Ottoman front proved more influential in the First World War than contemporaries ever imagined. Allied war planners, believing a quick victory over a weak Ottoman Empire might precipitate the Central Powers' surrender, found themselves drawn into a series of campaigns that lasted nearly the full length of the war. The battles in the Caucasus and Persia, the failed attempt to force the Dardanelles, the reversals in Mesopotamia, and the long campaign through Sinai, Palestine, and Syria diverted hundreds of thousands of men and strategic war materiel from the primary theatres of operations on the western and eastern fronts. Rather than hastening the end of the conflict, the Ottoman front served instead to lengthen the war. Much of the Allied war effort in the Middle East was driven by what proved to be an unwarranted fear of jihad. While colonial Muslims remained largely unresponsive to the Ottoman Sultan Caliph's appeal, the European imperial powers continued to assume that any major Turkish success or Allied setback might provoke the dreaded Islamic uprising in their colonies in India and North Africa. Ironically, this left the Allies more responsive to the Caliph's call than his Muslim target audience. Even a century later, the Western world has yet to shake off the belief that Muslims might act in a collectively fanatical manner. As the War on Terrorism, after 11 September 2001, has demonstrated, Western policymakers continue to view jihad in terms reminiscent of the war planners from 1914 to 1918. The First World War was itself tremendously influential in the making of the modern Middle East. With the fall of the Ottoman Empire, European imperialism replaced Turkish rule. After 4 centuries united in a multinational empire under Ottoman Muslim rule, the Arabs found themselves divided into a number of new states under British and French domination. A few countries achieved independence within frontiers of their own devising. Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia stand out in this regard. The imperial powers, however, imposed the borders and systems of government of most states in the region as part of the post-war settlement. The post-war partition of the Ottoman Empire was the subject of intense negotiations between the Allies that ran the length of the war. In hindsight, each of the partition agreements only makes sense within its wartime context. The Constantinople Agreement of 1915, when the Allies anticipated the quick conquest of Istanbul, the Hussein-McMahon correspondence in 1915 and 1916, when the British needed a Muslim ally against the Ottoman Jihad, the Balfour Declaration in 1917, when the British wanted to revise the terms of the Sykes-Picot Agreement to secure Palestine for British rule. These outlandish agreements, which were only conceivable in wartime, were concluded solely to advance Britain and France's imperial expansion. Had the European powers been concerned with establishing a stable Middle East, one can't help but think they would have gone about drafting the boundaries in a very different way. The borders of the post-war settlement have proven remarkably resilient, as have the conflicts the post-war boundaries have engendered. The Kurdish people, divided between Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria, have been embroiled in conflict with each of their host governments over the past century, in pursuit of their cultural and political rights. Lebanon, created by France in 1920 as a Christian state, succumbed to a string of civil wars as its political institutions failed to keep pace with its demographic shifts and Muslims came to outnumber Christians. Syria, unreconciled to the creation of Lebanon from what many Syrian nationalists believed to be an integral part of their country, sent its military to occupy Civil War Lebanon in 1976 and remained in occupation of that country for nearly 30 years. Despite its natural and human resources, Iraq has never known enduring peace and stability within its post-war boundaries, experiencing a coup and conflict with Britain in World War II, revolution in 1958, war with Iran between 1980 and 1988, and a seemingly unending cycle of war since Saddam Hussein's 1991 invasion of Kuwait and the 2003 American invasion of Iraq to topple Hussein. Yet the Arab-Israeli conflict, more than any other legacy of the post-war partition, has defined the Middle East as a war zone. Four major wars between Israel and its Arab neighbors in 1948, 1956, 1967, and 1973 have left the Middle East with a number of intractable problems that remain unresolved despite peace treaties between Israel and Egypt in 1979 and between Israel and Jordan in 1994. Palestinian refugees remain scattered between Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. Israel continues to occupy the Syrian Golan Heights and the Sheba farms in southern Lebanon, and Israel has yet to relinquish its control over the Palestinian territories of Gaza and the West Bank. While Israel and its Arab neighbors share primary responsibility for their actions, the roots of their conflict can be traced directly back to the fundamental contradictions of the Balfour Declaration. The legitimacy of Middle Eastern frontiers has been called into question since they were first drafted. Arab nationalists in the 1940s and 1950s openly called for unity schemes between Arab states that would overthrow boundaries widely condemned as an imperialist legacy. Pan-Islamists have advocated a broader Islamic union with the same goal. In 2014, a militia calling itself the Islamic State tweeted to its followers that it was smashing Sykes-Picot when it declared a caliphate in territory spanning northern Syria and Iraq. One century later, the borders of the Middle East remain controversial and volatile. The centenary of the Great War attracted little commemoration in the Middle East. Aside from Gallipoli, where Turkish and Anzac veteran associations have long gathered to remember their war dead, the struggles and sacrifices of the global armies that fought on the Ottoman front have given way to more pressing contemporary concerns. Revolutionary turmoil in Egypt, civil war in Syria and Iraq, and enduring violence between Israelis and Palestinians preoccupied the Middle East on the 100th anniversary of the start of the Great War. Yet, as the war is remembered in the rest of the world, the part the Ottomans played in that conflict must be taken into account. For the Ottoman front, with its Asian battlefields and global soldiers, turned Europe's Great War into the First World War. And in the Middle East, more than in any other part of the world, the legacies of the Great War continue to be felt down to the present day. This concludes The Fall of the Ottomans by Eugene Rogan, narrated by Derek Perkins. Copyright 2015 by Eugene Rogan. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Eugene Rogan and Inkwell Management, and was produced in the year 2015 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Please visit tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.